Welcome into the show on this Tuesday morning in Music City, USA. That's right, it is The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. I'm Ryan Porth in the Wholesale Inc. studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Once again, without Chase McCabe, as Chase McCabe makes his way down to Bridgestone Arena, as he and Darren McFarland will be broadcasting live from Bridgestone Arena for day two of Nashville Predators training camp. Austin Watson will be joining them at 10:15 this morning. The Preds completed day one yesterday, a successful day one, and no Predators players opted out before last night's deadline. So good news on that front. All the Nashville Predators are seemingly healthy, so good news on that front as well. So we'll be talking a little bit more Preds later on in the program. But I do want to start with Adam Schefter's tweet from, I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning this morning. It was early. I had just woken up. It wasn't 3 o'clock. I did not wake up at 3 o'clock this morning. But I believe around 5:30 a.m., Adam Schefter put it out there that Derrick Henry and the Tennessee Titans are unlikely to reach a long-term deal before tomorrow's deadline for franchise players to come to any sort of agreement beyond the franchise tender. And the franchise tender that Derrick Henry signed with the Tennessee Titans earlier this offseason is worth just over $10 million. Derrick Henry will be operating in the 2020 season, it sounds like, under the one-year franchise tag, and would be scheduled to become a free agent in the offseason. And, you know, this isn't necessarily a surprise, but I do think some Titans fans are concerned. 615-737-1025. Are you concerned that Derrick Henry and the Titans seemingly will not get a deal done? We'll read your texts and take your calls this segment if you do want to weigh in. And I want to know why this isn't happening. I want to know why Derrick Henry and the Titans aren't going to get a deal done. Is it because Derrick Henry's asking price all offseason long has been too high, considering that he was the bell cow for a team that went to the AFC Championship? He was the reason why they went to the AFC Championship. He was the leading rusher for the entire NFL in 2019. Now, it could also be because of the pandemic and some of the domino effects of this pandemic in the National Football League. Adam Schefter did say in his tweet this morning that deals made with franchise players would be the exception and not the rule this summer. So that begs the question from me, how much is the salary cap going to be impacted by the pandemic? If there's no fans, if they play a reduced schedule this season in 2020, how is that going to impact the salary cap compared to where it would have been under normal times? And if it will be impacted and either be a flat cap or even come back, I don't think the Titans want to lock themselves into a deal that would take up more cap space than they would prefer for someone like Derrick Henry. I bring in Marquise Munson behind the glass. Marquise, what's kind of your first initial thought when you hear this news about Derrick Henry not getting a deal with the Titans?
I'm not surprised, but I do think that everything you said plays a little bit of part of it. Now, I respect Derrick Henry and the Titans for keeping this quiet, because we, as we've seen with other free agency, you know, free agents has not been so much quiet. It's been all over Twitter, hence the Jacksonville Jaguars and their issues they have with their players. But I think that plays a part as far as the money he's asking for, because if he's asking around the same price range as probably a Christian McCaffrey, who's making $16 million per year, so maybe he's asking, maybe that's too much for the Titans to give him. I think also, the pandemic does play a part in it, but I think also is the Jadeveon Clowney factor and them wanting to save some cap space for possibly signing him. Now, that's a 50-50 shot, because guess what? If he doesn't sign with the Titans, it just, so fans are going to look at it like this. So we didn't sign Clowney. You didn't sign Derrick Henry to a long-term deal, making him a free agent, you know, next year in a big free agency class for running backs. And then, not to mention, you traded Jarrell Casey, which we all loved. So you did all these three things, and it was all for nothing because we didn't get Clowney. So that's how a lot of fans are probably going to look at it.
Yeah, I don't think this is the worst news for the Tennessee Titans, especially with the ongoing pandemic and what could happen to the salary cap because of that. I also don't think it's the worst thing for the Titans because it's not like there's animosity between the two sides, or at least publicly. This isn't a Le'Veon Bell and Pittsburgh Steelers type of situation going on between Derrick Henry and the Tennessee Titans. And while all Titans fans, including myself, want to see Derrick Henry in a Titans uniform and feel like he'll play at a high level for the next 3 to 4 years, there's no guarantee that he will remain elite for that entire time. As sold as I am that it would happen, that if you sign him to a 3-year deal, that you would not regret it at the end of that deal. I mean, the reality of running backs in the NFL is that is a short shelf life. Now, Derrick Henry doesn't have the wear and tear as someone like a Sean Alexander back in the day, 15 years ago, when he got a deal from the Seattle Seahawks that made him the highest paid running back ever. And then he just completely fell off a cliff after that, after he took the Seahawks to a Super Bowl. Larry Johnson with the Kansas City Chiefs had two monster seasons, got paid, and went completely downhill. I think Titans fans,
David Johnson? Yeah. David Johnson included too?
Look, there are so many more cases for running backs getting paid and it not working out than the opposite happened.
Yeah, see, I understand that narrative, and look, I get it. Like, you don't want to play running backs, especially once they get past 30, that shelf life continues to, you know, spiral downhill. But I'm not saying that the Titans should pay him because, you know, he deserves it because, you know, of what he did last year. I'm not saying that either, but you got to pay for talent. And you're going to guess what? All those issues that you mentioned with players and the history of paying players at that position, you're probably going to get that with a lot of other positions too. There's been bad quarterback deals. There's been bad wide receiver deals. There's been, you know, people that gotten paid at positions that they probably shouldn't have got paid for, but they did anyways, and then all of a sudden they end up regretting it. Well, you're going to get that with every position, though.
Way too many times in sports, not just the NFL, but sports as a whole.
Yeah, sports in general.
You get paid for what you've done and not what you're going to do within the entirety of that contract you're signing.
That's like me saying, okay, there's not a lot of Duke players that don't last in the NBA, so let me not draft Zion because they have a bad reputation of like,
or USC Duke, quarterbacks.
Or USC quarterbacks. It's that same narrative. And I don't – look, I'm all about paying a guy for his talent. That's the reason why Christian McCaffrey got his $16 million, because guess what? He's your leading wide receiver and your leading running back. So you can't justify not paying a guy like that. And maybe – yeah, Derrick Henry's a little bit one-dimensional compared to what other running backs are, like Alvin Kamara, who's going to be a free agent next year with Derrick Henry. So he's probably going to be the top, you know, no offense to Derrick Henry, but talent-wise, Alvin Kamara offers you a little bit more than Derrick Henry.
Yeah, especially in today's NFL.
So in today's NFL. So his market is going to be a little bit bigger than Derrick Henry's because of what he has to offer in the run game and wide receiver. So, yeah, Derrick Henry's one-dimensional, but guess what? He's talented. And he can be the backbone of your offense. And that's what he was with the Titans. So, look, I'm all about paying Derrick Henry. I'm a component of paying the man what the money that he deserves, but it's just not going to be this year, and it's unfortunate for
him. So I also think a motivated Derrick Henry in, yet again, another contract year is not the worst thing for the Titans either. Because Derrick Henry, look, he is a team-first guy, and I guarantee you that was the first thing and primary thing on his mind in Week 17 in the wild card round and the divisional round when he absolutely ate Houston, New England, and Baltimore for lunch and dinner in those games, in those victories for the Tennessee Titans. But you can't tell me that he didn't have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder to get paid in the offseason. And he didn't get that contract, so having a motivated Derrick Henry I don't think is the worst thing either for the 2020 season, assuming that they do play this season. And also, not only for him, but we've heard a lot of current Titans, a lot of former Titans come out and say that Derrick Henry needs to get paid. They could be motivated as well to help Derrick Henry get paid what they think he deserves. I mean, Taylor Lewan has been vocal about that. Taylor Lewan, if you have a motivated Taylor Lewan in the run game, just a little extra from him to try to get Derrick Henry his due, I don't think that's the worst thing either.
Yeah, it is. And I'm going to ask you this because next year's free agency for running backs is going to be major. Derrick Henry now, Dalvin Cook, Alvin Kamara, Aaron Jones, Joe Mixon, Kenyon Drake, Todd Gurley, Leonard Fournette, James Conner, like Kareem Hunt, Philip Lindsay, Tariq Cohen. There's a lot of free agency running backs. And the question's going to be, where does Derrick Henry fall in those free agencies? Because when you look at Alvin Kamara and a guy like Kenyon Drake, who you can do multiple things with, or, you know, you can use them in their offense as a Swiss Army knife, they're a little bit more, you know, mm-hmm. they're going to be probably going to ask in the same price range as a Christian McCaffrey. So then you have to figure out, okay, we're going to have to pay Derrick Henry either around that or a little bit less than that.
I don't think that's a great thing for Derrick Henry, because if teams need a running back, there are a lot of other running backs out there.
But see, that's why he should have got paid now. And that's probably why he wanted to get paid now, because if you're going that free agency class, that's a lot. That's a lot of potential there.
That brings me back to the first question of me wanting to know why. I want to know why this didn't happen. Is it because Derrick Henry outpriced himself, or is it because of the uncertainty around the pandemic? And it could be a little bit of both. You combine the two, and it would make sense why Derrick Henry did not get that contract this offseason and will not get it before the Wednesday deadline, according to Adam Schefter. But I do want to know why. 615-737-1025 if you want to text in. Nate from Nashville texting in, I originally wasn't concerned, but now I am. It will be difficult for Henry to get paid next season with the COVID-19 impact. I don't think he will hold out this season, but I wouldn't be surprised if he gets picked up by another team next season if the Titans can't sign him for another season. Well, yeah, he's going to get picked up if the Titans.
Oh, yeah, easily.
I mean, even if he takes a step back this season, someone will go out there and get him. And we're also getting tweets in about whether or not you're concerned. And Westside Fireman on Twitter says, might be best in the long run. Just franchise him or do a 2 to 3 year deal. The next huge long-term running back deal that works out will be the first in a long time. Which makes me think, what is the last running back contract that truly worked out?
Hmm.
When you look at the duration of the contract and say, you know what, that running back, it worked out. Because look, Adrian Peterson got paid huge money in Minnesota. Adrian Peterson, going into the 2011 season, had an amazing rookie contract. He got paid 6 years, $86 million. He had a 2,000-yard season. I believe it was in 2012, when he had just a monster season. He was at his peak, but within that contract, he did have a couple significant injuries. So I would want to know from Vikings, from people who follow the Vikings a lot closer than we do, whether or not they feel like that deal panned out with AP. But it certainly is a valid point of running backs, and it's something that I know a lot of people think the Titans are better off not signing Derrick Henry to a long-term deal rather than making him one of the highest-paid running backs in the National Football League. Coming up next year on The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game, we catch up with Peter Burns of the SEC Network. Greg Sankey yesterday provided a little bit more of an update after the SEC ADs all met. We'll get Peter Burns' thoughts on everything in college football coming up next year on The Rundown. I'm Ryan Porth. He's Marquise Munson on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into the show. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson here with you on a Tuesday morning. We are now joined by Peter Burns of the SEC Network here on the program. Peter, how are we doing this morning?
I'm good. Was that a little Pete Rock and CL Smooth coming back from break?
Yes, it was. I think you are
reminisce over you,
Peter Burns. I think you already know that that's exactly what that was. I think that's like one of your jams, so I have to play it for you, man.
I like old school rap and hip hop. I'm good. Like, it's always funny because I'll get so, like, it just puts you in a good mood. Like a rejoin, whoever does rejoin music, that's like one of the most like undervalued positions in sports talk radio, because it completely just changes the mode you go into to start a segment. So yeah, that was good stuff.
Absolutely. Marquise Munson knows what he's doing when it comes to the rejoin music. But speaking of good moods, or maybe not very good moods, when you think of SEC football, Peter, with Greg Sankey, some of his comments here in the last few days, Saturday morning, went on ESPN radio and mentioned that his concern for college football this season is high to very high, and he expressed a lot of his same concerns with Paul Feinbaum yesterday. What are your thoughts when you hear Greg Sankey comment right now on the state of SEC football and his concern for college football in 2020?
Yeah, not shocked. I mean, it's what we've been saying daily on our SiriusXM show for about the last month, is the fact that once you started seeing these numbers start pop up, that you realize, hey, this was serious. And, you know, and the more and more we get closer to what we would think the college football start of the season is that, you know, you've had more and more people understand that, listen, if these numbers are going up, regardless of what you think of it, if the numbers are going up, the advisors, the medical people, the university presidents are not going to look at this and go, all right, well, numbers are going up, but we got to play football. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so that's the harsh reality of it. And I think Greg Sankey at some point had kind of reached a little bit of a tipping point going, listen, this is the reality. Like, it's no, you know, bright eyes and bushy tails. Like, if we continue on this path right now, we're not going to have college football. And we're in a 2 to 3 week period right now that if this thing doesn't at least stabilize, then you're at least pushing the season back, if not canceling the season entirely, which is just mind-boggling when it comes down to it.
When you hear Greg Sankey make these appearances, and Greg Sankey has been very available to a lot of radio stations, including ours, since he took over as commissioner, but specifically in these last few days, do you feel like he's doing this on purpose as a last-ditch effort to get the word out that people listening, if you want college football, you better be doing the right things when it comes to the pandemic?
I don't know if that's his strategy, but I hope in hell it is, right? I mean, right. I think when you have a commissioner who obviously, listen, he loves the SEC, he loves the fact that he can go into a college football playoff and know, hey, we're always going to be here. We got a pretty damn good chance of happening. Like, no one sits in that chair that's more happy about SEC domination, especially in football, than Greg Sankey. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's all of us. I think that's all of us that are around college football have been shouting from the rooftops that, hey, are we willing to do the bare minimum of trying to get this thing done? Let's just talk about for human society. Like, of course, that's the right thing to do. But if you do want to see football, especially fans in the stadiums, and at that point, I don't even know if that's even available as an option now, what are you willing to, I wouldn't even say sacrifice, what are you just willing to meet in the middle about? And it's just, and I think Sankey has talked about it a couple of times about there's been, you know, and not necessarily Sankey, but people have talked about, oh, it's so politicized now that it just seems kind of like a, hey, can we all just come together and save college football? And sadly, I still don't think that's going to change. And if that's not going to change, then the prospects of having college football are grim.
Peter Burns of the SEC Network here with us on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Peter, for you, even if the health trends do go the right way in the coming days and weeks, in your mind, what's the biggest obstacle to pulling off not only a successful start to the season, but let alone a finish?
I think obviously it's making sure you have good testing protocols. And, you know, these coaches have told me that, you know, top to bottom, it costs about $14,000, $15,000 every time you're going to run one of these tests throughout your whole college football team. So, you know, are your opponents testing? And I think that's why the Big Ten and that's why the Pac-12 had said, hey, we're just going to play conference-only schedules. Like, we don't know what other conferences are doing or what other schools are doing. Let's just all work with all our own individual conferences on testing, and it gives them some schedule flexibility. So, you know, I think for us, it's the idea of, can you make the college kids safe? I mean, Kentucky football right now, just had their test. 166 kids, players, and staffers tested. Not a single one of them had coronavirus. Not one. Not one person tested positive. Now, that's also without students on campus. And I think the biggest issue, guys, is what happens when kids do get back on campus. Because it's a whole lot easier when you're just with your boys practicing, you're social distancing, you're lifting weights and whatnot. Hey, everybody can kind of be apart from each other. But I don't know, if I was 18, 19-year-old kid and I know that, man, I'm sick and tired of this and there's a party with, you know, unbelievable amount of people, I'm going to probably go to that party. I mean, y'all would have, right? I mean, I'd love to say that I'd be disciplined enough, but there will be people that kind of break that bubble once college starts, and what happens then is the big mystery.
We're talking to Peter Burns of the SEC Network, and bringing students back on campus, too, with the addition of that, because don't you think that college football is in this tough dilemma that no professional sports is under of, if you're going to allow students back on campus, then, I mean, what's to say that you can't allow fans in the stadiums, and then also, how do you protect your students? Is that kind of how you see it a little bit, of if you're going to allow students on campus, I mean, you're going to have this tough dilemma of having fans in stands?
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, well, if you do this, you're allowed this. You know, if I give you an inch, you're going to take a yard. And so that is the dilemma that everyone is looking at right now of saying, all right, do you have kids on campus? If it is, okay, well, then can you go to a game? All right, if you go to a game, who can go? Can season ticket holders go? Can only the people in the suites go? Can the students go? Okay, well, these people can go, these people can't. I mean, that's why it's such a complex issue, and there's no game plan, right? There's no guidebook. Like, no one has been through, well, I guess they have been through this back in 1918, right? But over 100 years ago, I think the game plan has changed a little bit. So I don't envy anybody making these decisions. I don't envy the athletic directors. I don't envy the players who have to decide. I mean, I talked to an athletic director, not in the SEC, but a group of five school yesterday, who personally told me, he goes, I've asked all of our players, and he goes, about 97% of them said, I just want to play football. I want to play. That the players want to play, the universities want to play. But at the end of the day, as much as these athletic directors and college football leaders are painted as, oh, they just want to play for the money, they're not going to play if they don't feel like it's safe. And it's a bad cause, because then that's going to be on their legacy. And that's why these next 2-3 weeks are imperative. Like, if we don't figure this out in 3 weeks, the chances of having college football this fall are minuscule.
And with every other sport, you look at, everyone's had to make adjustments. We've seen the NHL have to make adjustments. We've seen even the NBA, who for the longest period of time, people wanted them to push their season back. And due to the pandemic, they're having to push their season, their beginning of their next season, back to December. And it gives teams opportunities to kind of figure things out for the future. And one thing in particular for the SEC has been adding one more maybe SEC game instead of a non-conference game. SEC has 4 non-conferences. The rest of them have 3. And if you're going to do this conference-only play thing, obviously the SEC is going to have to add a game, in which, to me, I've been a big component of, look, let's just add one more game out of, you know, SEC East or West. Maybe we get a matchup like a Tennessee and Auburn, or an Alabama and Florida. So do you think that's the plan of them kind of for the long haul of, like, okay, it's finally time to, we're going to do conference only. We're going to have 9 games. So we're going to have to add another SEC game to that.
It's intriguing, and I haven't talked to anybody in the SEC. I just don't know if they at any point would go to additional games. And, you know, they've played 8 conference games. Are you going to take that back? I don't know, because guess what? I mean, everyone else plays 9 conference games traditionally. You know, the SEC and the ACC only play 8. Well, there's only 2 conferences that have made the college football playoff every single year. It's the SEC and the ACC, the 2 teams that only play 8 conference games. So I don't know if they would be that quick, if they do eventually go to a conference-only schedule, to add another game. I mean, again, I think this is about getting games in and making sure that you're safe doing it. And if you're saying, hey, we're trying to be as safe as possible, does adding games to the schedule help? I don't necessarily think that's going to be the case. So I'm not sure. I would still probably just go with a 8-game schedule, because college football, I mean, it's going to look different no matter what. And there's no uniformity here in 2020, and that's the reality of it.
Yeah, and Peter, we talk about the Power 5 and the impact they have, and we had this discussion yesterday of, what about the other conferences? What about the Conference USAs and the Sun Belts and those teams that not only will probably have to go conference only, but you're losing out on that Power 5 matchup that you're getting paid for to, you know, go visit. And, you know, Middle Tennessee here is not going to be able to play a team like Duke because they're conference only. So talk about the impact of that, because I think that's one thing that's getting shied away from all this as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, my good friend Will Healy, who's head coach over here at Charlotte, but, you know, Charlotte's going to open up against Tennessee this year. They're supposed to get $1.3 million. And I remember back when he was at Austin Peay, they got, you know, what, $700,000 to play Georgia. That's a big chunk. You know, that's a huge part of their football budget and their athletic budget. And that's going to be missed out this year if all these teams go conference-only schedules. But, you know, as much as we talk about how bad it'll hurt the Group of Five, and it does, when they lose out, they lose $4 million, right, of revenue for football if they don't. If Georgia doesn't play, they're going to lose $40 million of revenue. Iowa State just came out yesterday and says we're going to lose $50 to $75 million if college football is being played. Like, you can replace $4 or $5 million at a university. Replacing $75 million is a whole different story. So, you know, the idea that the group of five schools are much more dangerous than the Power Five schools, I don't necessarily buy that, because there's a lot of Power Five schools that sure as hell can't afford not to lose $70 million. Like, you know, I think Georgia has a good rainy day fund and a couple other schools do, but, you know, I'm not sure if every single Power Five university has this piggy bank of money that has been saved.
Peter Burns of the SEC Network here with us, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Peter, is the last week in your mind further proof that college football could really use a commissioner?
Yeah, but it's also made me realize that I don't think we'll ever have one, right? I mean, you know, I can't imagine, you know, Greg Sankey and all the conferences and these commissioners get together and go, hey, let's have one more boss that's going to handle all of our conversations above us. You know, like, mm-hmm. I don't see that happening. Like, in theory, it's awesome. Like, why would we not have somebody, right? Like, let's go ahead and put whoever it may be on, you know, Nick Saban when he retires. Nick, you're the czar. Are these conference commissioners going to say, all right, let's all, you know, give our power to one person in college football who's going to make blanket decisions? I don't know. I don't think that's the case. So I think it's an idea in theory that works, but in reality, I don't think it actually will ever happen.
Peter, leave us with this. What does your gut tell you? Do we see college football in 2020?
I think we do see college football. Now, do we finish it? I'm not sure, because this thing continues to change. But, yeah, I do think that – I think eventually what we'll see is a pushback of the start of the season for all the conferences. And I do think that there will be conference games being played and hopefully non-conference games here in the SEC as well. They're not ready to make that decision. But push comes to shove, I do think that we'll have some type of college football. It may not start until late September or early October. But I say that with the caveat of everybody trying to pitch in, and you know, I don't know how is it in Nashville. I mean, are people wearing, you know, how's the whole mask thing going on? Is are people adhering to it or not adhering to it? Like, what's it like in y'all's neck of the woods?
It's kind of hit and miss. I mean, my wife and I were out at a home department store over the weekend, and not many people were following the mask protocols, and it's disheartening, because I think a lot of people have been impatient with it and just say, you know what, it's been long enough. We're just going to go on with our daily lives. And it's not like when we were all quarantined for 2-3 months, it's not like the virus just went away.
Yeah. And for me, Peter, you know, I went back to Tuscaloosa this weekend because, you know, that's where I'm originally from. And, you know, Before going back, I heard that, you know, Tuscaloosa was pretty lax about it. I don't think people really cared. One of my friends said she got harassed by wearing a mask at one point, and it was really bad. But when I went out there this weekend, it seemed like they were starting to get going to what you're supposed to do, wear a mask. Any place that we went to, we had to wear a mask. Every waitress was wearing a mask. So it seems like now that you threaten college football over Tuscaloosa, it's just like, okay, now we got to do this. So it's been a little different now.
Well, and again, that's why, I mean, sometimes it didn't help when we had some athletic directors saying, hey, we're going to have 80,000 in the stands and it's going to be fine. Or Dabo saying, absolutely, we're going to have it. Because then people said, all right, well, hey, if they're saying we're going to have it, they know. Like, we don't have to do any of this stuff. Like, I'm not going to wear a mask. And now I think that's why Greg Sankey and other people have come out and go, this is dire. Like, if we've got 3 to 4 weeks, and I'm legitimately saying that, if this thing does not stabilize in 3 or 4 weeks, college football goes away. And, you know, I'm willing to do it. Do I think it's the end all be all? No, but am I willing to at least pitch in to try to help? Sure, because I like college football. And by the way, I like old people and as well too. So, like, let's try to help out, and hopefully we're talking ball the next time we're having these conversations.
Case in point, Peter, the mayor's office just put out their daily release, saying that there's been an increase of 771 cases in the past 24 hours in Nashville. That is the largest increase since mid-March. So, yeah, everybody, if you want college football, just wear your mask, please.
It seems simple, and yet I go around and some people don't get it. And I guess know. What? They're going to say, you know, in 3 months from now when we're not having college football, they're going to be complaining about it. And the people that weren't wearing the mask, they'll be like, well, I appreciate you not pitching in for
yeah.
And now we can't have the things that we all want. So
exactly. Crazy. Exactly. Peter Burns of the SEC Network has been our guest. Peter, thank you for your time this morning, and fingers crossed that we do get college football here in 2020.
You got it, boys. Y'all be safe out there.
You too. Peter Burns of the SEC Network. Great stuff, as always, from Peter. And echoing a lot of what Greg Sankey's been saying the last few days of you have, if you want college football in 2020, you have to start following or resume following the health protocols that you were following up until, like, Memorial Day. It seemed like when Memorial Day hit, a lot of people, and that's when cities and counties, not only in our region but across the nation, across the region, started opening up a little bit more, and I think that's when people got a little lax with all the protocols. So everybody, please, please, please wear your mask when you're out in public, wash your hands, follow all of those protocols, because if you don't, I mean, like he said, the next 2 weeks are going to be critical to whether or not we get college football in 2020. But speaking of sports and hopefully a return, which is the Nashville Predators on August 2nd against the Arizona Coyotes in the qualifying round, many people think the biggest question for the Preds is who starts in net. There may be a more important question at hand. We'll explain coming up next here on The Rundown. I'm Ryan Porth. He's Marquise Munton on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munton here with you on this Tuesday morning. It is day two of Nashville Predators training camp for from Bridgestone Arena. Full coverage coming up at 10. Darren McFarland and Chase McCabe will be high atop Bridgestone Arena with all the latest from the arena for camp. Austin Watson will join them at 10:15. The team will hit the ice at noon once again today. They'll also do it all again tomorrow with the show there from 10 to 2 and practice starting at noon today and tomorrow. So keep it locked right here, ESPN 102.5 The Game. And the biggest question leading into this training camp slash qualifying round for the Nashville Predators has been, which goalie's going to start? Is it Pekka or is it UC Saros? And, yes, that is a big question. It's a burning question. Even ESPN.com, when they came out with some of their biggest questions surrounding the entire National Hockey League, in the league's return, Pekka Rinne or UC Saros has consistently been one of the top league-wide questions, not just here with the Nashville Predators. But there may be a more important question at hand with the Nashville Predators, and Jared Stillman brought this up with me yesterday when I sat in with him during the 5 o'clock hour. And that is a more important question for this Nashville Predators team as it pertains to their ability to make a run in this postseason may not have anything to do with Pekka Rinne or UC Saros, and may have everything to do with their number one center. Their number one center being Ryan Johansson. Ryan Johansson this past season was on pace at the season pause for, I believe it was 36 points if he were to complete the 82-game season. 36 points. They're paying him $8 million. He was on pace for 36 points and I believe about 23 or 24 assists after a season in which he dominated with assists. That line, the Jofa line with Philip Forsberg, Ryan Johansson, Victor Arvidsson, was so good last season. And when I say last season, I mean the 18-19 season and the seasons prior to that. One of the top lines in the entire league. And for whatever reason, from the start of the 2019 playoffs against Dallas, that line just completely faded away. And when they were put together by Peter Laviolette in the first half of the season, they didn't produce all that much, and they didn't look like themselves. And a big reason for that, in my opinion, was Ryan Johansson and the fact that he was not playing to the ability and to the level that we all know Ryan Johansson is capable of. When you go back and watch the 2017 playoffs, and I'll even throw the 2018 playoffs in there. Everybody talks about the 2017 postseason, the fact that Ryan Johansson, before he got hurt, was phenomenal. And he was. He was phenomenal before he got hurt. And the whole question of what would have happened against Pittsburgh if Ryan Johansson had been healthy instead of being hurt. But the 2018 postseason against Colorado and Winnipeg in those two series, I mean, that Jofa line was clicking on all cylinders, and Ryan Johansson was dominant yet again in that postseason. He had 14 points in 13 games in the 2018 postseason after registering 13 points in 14 games in 2017. But last year, 2019 against the Dallas Stars, where they got ousted in six games, Ryan Johansson only had 2 points, and that line was pretty non-existent throughout that entire postseason series against the Dallas Stars. And Ryan Johansson, when he's clicking on all cylinders, can be the straw that stirs the entire offensive drink for the Nashville Predators. And he had a season this year that was completely forgettable. He had 36 points in 68 games for the Nashville Predators. So those were his point totals leading up to the season pause, not the on pace numbers, but still 36 points in 68 games. You're paying him $8 million. You expect Ryan Johansson to be producing like he did in the 18-19 regular season, where he had 50 assists, 64 points. He was dominating and setting up Philip Forsberg and Victor Arvidsson at a high, high level. And for whatever reason, the 19-20 regular season, it just wasn't happening for Ryan Johansson. But he's been vocal in the last 4 months about this period being a reset button, not only for the team, but for himself as well. And if this period of time, if this layoff is a reset for him, why can't it be a reset of expectations for Ryan Johansson and what we expect out of him as this team's number one center, or 1A center to maybe Matt Duchene's 1B. Ryan Johansson has all the talent in the world to be a consistent 20-goal scorer, and I'll even say a 70-point guy in this league. Now, he usually fulfills his potential and those expectations in the playoffs, specifically 2017 and 2018, like I mentioned. But Ryan Johansson, we all know, has a much larger gear than what he showed in the 19-20 regular season. And if the Predators are to make a run and to get past this qualifying round against the Arizona Coyotes and really do some damage, like we all know they can, we know this team is capable of a lot more than what they've shown really since the calendar switched from 2018 to 2019, Ryan Johansson needs to be a big part of that. And how Ryan Johansson plays against Arizona or beyond could dictate how far they go, no matter who is in between the pipes, whether it's Pekka, whether it's UC Saros. Yes, it's a huge decision that John Hines has to make with game one, which goalie to go with. But perhaps the more important question for this Nashville Predators team and their success when they return to action starting August 2nd against the Arizona Coyotes is Ryan Johansson, and which Ryan Johansson shows up. Is it the Ryan Johansson of the 17 and 18 postseasons, where he was clearly a bona fide number one center in those postseasons? Or is it the Ryan Johansson that was non-existent in the 2019 postseason and for much of the 19-20 regular season? I feel like that is a more important question than who starts between the pipes for the Nashville Predators. Speaking of the Nashville Predators, yesterday, John Hines said that even though Roman Josi and Colton Sissons did not partake in the practice session, the full practice session at noon, they did skate earlier in the morning, so that is a positive sign for the Nashville Predators. And once again, no Preds players opted out of practice. And, you know, one other big note, one footnote of practice yesterday was the fact that the Jofa line was put together by John Hines. Forsberg, Johansson, Arvidsson, they were put together. Hopefully John Hines can keep them together moving forward here in the next couple of weeks, see what they have at least in practice to see if they can rekindle some of that former chemistry, some of that old chemistry that they had. Because if they do, and that Jofa line is firing on all cylinders starting against Arizona in the qualifying round, I really like their chances of not only getting past the qualifying round against the Coyotes, but making noise beyond that series as well. Coming up next, an NBA player got his wrist slapped for exiting the bubble. We'll explain why coming up next. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson here with you on The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson here with you on this Tuesday evening. Darren Donick and Chase coming up at the top of the hour live from Bridgestone Arena. Chase McCabe will be checking in here in just a few minutes from the broadcast location up in the radio booth inside Bridgestone Arena. But I do want to get to this story where Rashawn Holmes of the Sacramento Kings is currently in quarantine in the NBA bubble down in Orlando. But he accidentally crossed the NBA's campus line to pick up a food delivery at the Walt Disney World Resort in Orlando, making him subject to a 10-day quarantine in his hotel room. Now, I've seen some tweets, I've seen some pictures of some NBA players not liking the food options that they have within the bubble, to which I say, suck it up, Buttercup. You're an NBA player making a lot of money. You get to play the sport that you love right now, or at least try to come back and play it. We're going through a pandemic. We all have to make sacrifices with some things. If the food isn't quite five-star restaurant quality, you know what? You might have to deal with it for the next month or two, or as long as you're playing, just to actually play instead of getting, you know, these grand home chef, you know, dinners or lunches or what have you. So just a goofy story in the NBA yesterday, Marquise. And that begs the question. I know Golic and Wingo brought this up this morning, and Adam Vingan actually tweeted this out yesterday with The Athletic, of what delivery food for you would be worth sitting in a 10-day quarantine for that Rashawn Holmes committed to, I guess, over the weekend.
I just love the NBA bubble. The NBA bubble has been the most entertaining thing. Well, and there's also a Twitter for the NBA bubble where, like, there's a Twitter account that just shares all these videos from players doing stuff in the bubble.
But they don't want to call it the bubble. What is it?
It is the campus.
The campus.
According to Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports, it is the campus.
So he crossed the lines of the NBA campus.
Of the NBA campus, and which is funny. And his mom tweeted, the only time you cross the line is when you get mama's cooking, which is true.
Yep, I will 100%. Definitely,
that is answer number one for me. Like, I'm crossing the line for mom or grandma's cooking, for that matter. Well,
what dish? What specific dish from mom or grandma?
My mom makes some bomb tacos.
Really?
Yes. They're really good.
What's special about them?
I don't know. It's the love, I guess. It's mama's love that's in it, in those tacos. I don't know. I can go to Taco Bell or anywhere else and eat the same exact taco, and it does not taste the same. See, these are made with love.
See, so my best man's mother makes the absolute best tacos I've ever had, and it's all because of the shell. The shell, she fries it, and then you put all the, you know, the meat and the cheese and lettuce and all that in the taco. But the shell is what makes it. And it's like this soft fried shell, and it is to die for. I would stay in a 10-day quarantine for those tacos.
Yeah, for sure. But I would have to have, like, a lot of those tacos, too, because, you know, it's like...
10 days is a long time.
Yeah, it's got to be worth it. But one thing that I was thinking about when I saw this, and this has been, like, one of the top answers for Golic and Wingo, I think, is Whataburger, which... Every time I go home, and I kid you not, every single time, it never fails. When I go back to Tuscaloosa for whatever how many days, I always eat Whataburger. Whether it's during the time I'm there or it's coming back to Nashville, I always eat at Whataburger.
I don't think people who haven't had Whataburger realize how good a Whataburger burger is.
Yes.
It is. I mean, it is sinful. It is an amazing burger. It is so much better than In-N-Out. In-N-Out is so overrated.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm from California.
I know you are. In-N-Out's overrated. I think a big draw for In-N-Out is because it's cheap. Because it's not expensive.
But it's also very good.
Five Guys is better than In-N-Out.
No, definitely
not.
Yes,
absolutely.
Not negative. It's In-N-Out, and then it's Whataburger. That's... And this is why I don't want an In-N-Out Burger in Tennessee, because you guys are ungrateful and you guys don't deserve an In-N-Out Burger, because you guys want to talk about it's overrated. Well, guess what? We'll stay in California and Texas and Arizona and wherever else they got In-N-Out Burgers, and we won't come to Nashville. How about that? Because you guys are ungrateful. In-N-Out Burger, don't come. Whataburger, however.
It's very good.
Come to Nashville.
I love Whataburger. But I also had the best burger of my life in Hilton Head during the during our honeymoon.
Like, it was one time that I went to California, I think, or Alabama. I think it was the week. I went back for a week, and I think I ate Whataburger four times that within that week.
Four times?
Yes.
Okay, so if In-N-Out was an option, what would the ratio have looked like?
Probably the same. Probably like four or five. Maybe five. Maybe a little one burger.
Five In-N-Outs and no Whataburgers?
Oh, yeah, probably so.
Man,
In-N-Out's my option, man. Like, it's number one for me. I don't want an In-N-Out here because it reminds me of home, and I don't want anything here that people are ungrateful for that reminds me of home.
I want Skyline Chili here from Cincinnati, and Skyline Chili would 1,000% be my answer on this question, because Skyline Chili, and I know it's, look, you either love it or you hate it, but I love me some Skyline Chili. So
see, I wouldn't chili dog. A chili dog, I would probably do
from Skyline Chili. Cheese Coney.
I've never had one from there particularly, but I'm just saying, if I had a chili cheese dog option,
oh yeah,
I'm taking it.
You have that at Skyline Chili.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I'm gonna have to try that. But
you will.
I'm trying to think of some local places, so we don't stop naming these franchises.
I'll give you a local place with burgers,
and that you'll 10-day quarantine for.
Gabby's.
Okay.
You ever had Gabby's?
I have not.
Gabby's Burgers, over near where Greer Stadium was in South Nashville. Very good. Gabby's Burgers is to die for. Do we have Chase McCabe up at Bridgestone Arena? Chase McCabe joining us here, joining the conversation. Chase McCabe, I'm sure you've heard the last couple minutes of this conversation.
I have thoughts.
Okay. So what? All right, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the food delivery that you would quarantine for, or do you have a thought on In-N-Out versus Whataburger?
Well, first, Gabby's is a very good recommendation by you. Gabby's is a wonderful spot behind the old Greer Stadium. So that was a good local recommendation by you, so I'll give you that.
Okay.
I like Whataburger, but I also like In-N-Out. And for you to say that In-N-Out is overrated, you, sir, are overrated.
Because, wow!
Because In-N-Out is...
It's overrated.
I like In-N-Out a lot.
It's overrated.
No,
see,
it's not.
And it's people like you. People like you is the reason why there is no In-N-Out Burger here. It's people like you that are ungrateful for the greatness that In-N-Out Burger has to offer. In-N-Out Burger is like a NBA free agency. And guess what destination it ain't coming to? Nashville. Because of you.
But, as for a delivery food, that I mean, it would probably be Chinese, because I could eat Chinese for every meal every day.
Oh.
So... That would probably be me. And it's got to be nothing against like a P.F. Chang's or a Pei Wei. I like those places. But like a hole-in-the-wall little Chinese joint, those are the best. Those are my favorite. So I would do that.
Mexican food. La Hacienda over near where Amanda and I live. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
La Hacienda.
Laja.
They have multiple locations around the Mid-State. Highly recommended.
If they were to deliver me a bucket of queso, a bucket, not like a little case. I want a bucket, because if I'm in a 10-day quarantine, I'm going to need a bucket.
All right.
It's for it to be worth
it. The queso that you would have loved, Marquise, is a place that used to be in Franklin, and I don't have any idea whether or not it's around anywhere anymore, because it's not in the current location in Franklin. But there was a place called Mickey Roo's on Hillsborough Pike in Franklin that had this brisket queso where – brisket was in the queso, and it was, I mean, I'm probably fat right now because of that brisket queso that I ate 10 years ago at Mickey Roo's. And it was like a once a week proposition.
I can deal with that. I'll do a 10-day quarantine for some queso and some wings. Queso, wings, Whataburger, and In-N-Out. Those would be the things. And my mama's tacos.
Okay.
Other than that, that's it.
All right. All right.
There you go.
Chase, would you vote for Skyline Chili in this conversation?
Absolutely. I wish Skyline was it. But see, here's the thing on this entire conversation. I know there's Whataburger maybe coming to Nashville, and that would be awesome. But the thing about Skyline or In-N-Out in the places we're talking about, it's you get excited because you can't have it all the time. And so you go, whenever you go to those places, it's like, all right, I'm going to Cincinnati, so I know I'm going to get Skyline Chili because I can't get it at home.
Well, you know what? I think a lot of people might think that way. I know I don't, because when I lived in Cincinnati, I think I had Skyline at least 2 times a week.
Yeah, your wife would not allow that now.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I would go get Skyline Chili on a lunch break at work so that I could at least eat Skyline Chili. Because I know we're not going to have it.
She's always watching you, man. That's part of your new set of rules.
I know, I know. All right, so I brought you on here, Chase, on our show.
To talk food.
To talk food, but also Pred. So in 30 seconds before we have to get out of here, what was kind of your takeaway from yesterday, and what's kind of the atmosphere like with practice at an empty arena within a pandemic?
Well, it's still weird because we're talking about hockey practice in July, in the middle of July.
Yeah.
But I was talking to somebody last night. I didn't see a lot of rust. Now, there probably was some, but it at least looked like these guys had been doing the preparation and out skating some. And so yesterday was a day of learning. I would expect John Hines will ramp it up today. That's something Hal Gill talked about with you yesterday of, you know, hey, you got to dive into this. You don't have a lot of time. So I expect that today. But so far, so good. I'm curious to see some of the line combinations again, if they go with the same stuff or if they mix it up. But it's good to be back, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, you and Darren will be holding down the fort once again coming up here in just a few minutes with Darren Donick
and Chase.
Yeah, his
hair looks amazing, by the way. It's on point today.
It's on point about 99% of the time.
That's true.
It really is. So thank you, Chase, for checking in.
Yep.
For Chase McCabe, I'm Ryan Porth. He's Marquise Munson behind the glass. This has been The Rundown. Coming up next, it is Darren Donick and Chase live from Bridgestone Arena right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.